We are pleased to inform you that you have a place at Potterversity.
Welcome to Potterversity, a Potter Studies podcast. On today's episode, Owl Post. Welcome to Potterversity. On today's episode, it's a special Owl Post where we will be reading listener emails. I am Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2, and co-editor with Emily Strand of Potterversity, essays exploring the world of Harry Potter.
And I am Emily Strand, director of campus ministry at Ohio Dominican University and co-editor with Amy Sturgis and with Katie McDaniel of three essays exploring books on Star Trek, Star Wars, and Harry Potter.
We are joined today by our producer, Lori Beckoff. Lori, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hello again. Yes, I'm producer Lori Beckoff. I'm also creative manager over at MuggleNet, creator of our academic section, Muggle Studies, and I'm the communications coordinator for the Harry Potter Academic Conference at Chestnut Hill College, as well as author of essays published in a couple of the books mentioned here.
Lori, you are very active, busy. I think you are like a kind of center point to a lot of the Harry Potter academic community. A lot of behind the scenes stuff that people don't necessarily know, but you're behind it.
I am the mysterious producer working behind the scenes and occasionally coming on to join the conversation, but I'm also the person who checks our email. So yes. If you are someone who ever sends us an email, I'm usually the first person to read it. And that's where we found all the great thoughts we want to talk about today.
Yes. And these kind of crystallized around two particular episodes. The two-part memory episode that we did got a lot of listener interest. And also, we have a little email about the monsters episode. So we're calling this episode Memory and Monsters. Yeah, so I wanted to ask today, since we're spending the whole episode talking about some things that our listeners have written in to us, how, you know, have you all ever sent in like a piece of, fan mail? Or have you written in to either a podcast or, a show of some kind, or maybe a favorite author?
So I've definitely written into some podcasts that I love. And I think, oh gosh, now I'm going to have trouble coming up with the names of these podcasts. But they're often very various, like Star Wars talk sort of podcasts. I probably did when I was a young person. I can't remember any specifics, but I'll tell you who I would have written to, and it would have been the acclaimed, legendary songwriter, James Taylor. I'm that kind of nerd. I would have written in to tell James Taylor how deeply I love his music, and really stalker middle schooler myself, yeah, him as well.
Nice.
Yeah, take that, for what it's worth and do with it what you will. I am still to this day obsessed with James Taylor. So
I always feel like I learn something about you with these little warm-up questions that I send out, Emily. Mm. Lori, what
and
about
sometimes
him?
You're disturbed at what you learn.
No. People are multivarious, interesting, paradoxical. It's all fun.
Nice. It's a nice way to put it.
What about you, Lori? Have you written any like fan mail, or it doesn't have to be like totally laudatory either? Have you written any mail to anybody?
So I feel like I must have at some point sent to an author I like, but the main thing that I think of is that when I was 10 years old, I saw the 25th annual Putnam County Spelling Bee on Broadway, and they take volunteer spellers to like come up and participate in the show. And at 10 years old, I got to be one of the spellers on stage, and I was the last one out because they make you actually spell. So I got like serenaded off stage, and I got the cast to sign my poster after, and it was super cool. And I found it was the original cast, which included Dan Fogler, who went on to be in Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, but it also had Jesse Tyler Ferguson, who went on to be on Modern Family. And he was a redhead. So, of course, little 10-year-old me was like, I liked that guy, the redhead. So I like found his actor website and sent him an email after, just saying, like, hi, I was that kid in the show last week with you. And I had such a good time. And I thought you were really, really great. And he responded to it, I think, about the word that I had, one of the words I had spelled, which, funnily enough, is a running joke in my family. It was abulia, which is indecision, which is something I suffer from. But yeah, I like had a little bit of a back and forth with him about that experience. So that's the first thing I think of. Another theater-related one more recently was that I read the book Hamilton: The Revolution. I think this is the book I'm thinking of that is about the making of Hamilton. And it was really interesting, like dramaturgical analysis of how it got made and through the public theater and all this other stuff. And I wrote to the author of that, Jeremy McCarter wrote that book with Lin-Manuel Miranda. And I think I wrote to him just to be like, this was really cool. I really liked seeing the behind the scenes of like how a show like this was made.
That's very cool.
It is very cool, but I want to comment about the spelling bee story because I've never heard a more Lori Beckoff story in my entire
This was
life.
one of my, like,
Everything about it.
to add into all my other nerdy credentials, when I was on Jeopardy, this was one of the stories I gave them. I think when I was still auditioning to be on Teen Jeopardy, this was like my number one story that I provided of like, I was one of the volunteer spellers in this Broadway show, which I don't think ever, and even by the time I was on Jeopardy in college, I don't think they ended up. Maybe that story was too old to use, but that has for a long time been my like fun fact story.
Love
Folks,
it.
you can send your fan mail to Lori Beckoff at pottervercitypodcast@gmail.com.
You
Doesn't
want
have to
to
be about the show. It can just be about Lori.
spell it for us?
It's the same as our social media. It's fine to figure it out.
Pottervercity. So yeah, so I did play a spelling bee champion in a play one time. The play was Eleemosynary. Eleemosynary. It means charitable, the giving of alms. That is one of the
I've never
words.
heard of this, but it sounds really interesting. Everyone send us your favorite spelling bee related piece of media.
Yeah, my 12-year-old is in the spelling bee coming up next week, and there's nothing more like suspenseful, like the tension of watching your kid spell in the spelling bee. I almost cannot handle it. It's so
Yeah.
intense. The spelling. So I am not the kind of person who likes to, I guess I just don't really like to engage in that way. Like, you be over there and I'll be over here and I'll enjoy it and I don't feel any compulsion to write about it. But of course, I feel so grateful to the people who write in to Pottervercity, you know, and I started to think about that. I was like, you know what? I'm going to, for my 50th birthday, I decided I was going to write, like, you know, fan letters to the authors who had influenced me and whose work I really admired. And I'm just going to tell you for real, I wrote these things and then I did not know where to send them. A lot of these authors do not, they want you to write an Amazon review and
Yeah.
they don't want your mail.
No.
So, but it was, I was like, oh, well, what I wrote them. And that was, so I wrote them sort of for myself, I guess.
Well, I think the modern equivalent now is like sending it to someone on social media. And that reminds me of two more like somewhat relevant ones to this group that I tweeted at Philip Pullman after the final season of his Dark Materials came out because I saw that he was responding to people on Twitter. So I was like, I'll say, wow, I really love this adaptation. Can't wait for the next book in his second series that's related to the initial one, The Book of Dust. And he did tweet back, like, yeah, they did a great job, right? So that was fun. And I also once tweeted at Melinda M. Snodgrass, who I don't know if you guys remember this name, but she wrote one of the best episodes of Star Trek of all time, TNG, The Measure of a Man.
Oh, classic,
And she's
classic.
active on Twitter, and I had seen that while I was, I think I was doing the Purdue, I was using the Purdue Owl citation style guide. And the example I think that they gave of citing an episode of TV was The Measure of a Man. So I
Yes, it
tweeted
is.
that and like at tagged her, like, yeah, the greatest episode of Star Trek. And I think she responded to that. So that was kind of my fan mail, was just like tweeting at someone.
That's cool. I had these were longer letters. They were not
You
tweet
can say something more
tweetable.
heartfelt and profound than
Yeah, but
like.
I actually did. You're reminding me. I sent an email to Timothy Snyder after he gave the keynote at the Harry Potter Academic Conference, just to say that I had, really loved his books, and that I had used them in a talk of my own, about Harry Potter and resisting totalitarianism in the Wizarding World, which I did at the Roanoke Generic Magic Festival. And so I had sent him that, and then I was like, just in case you want to see, I wrote something about this, and I sent him my Dumbledore's Army and the White Rose article, because I was like, I'll just attach it, he's not going to look at it. And he read it. He gave me the nicest email back, and he had read it, and he was like, this is my favorite part of your essay.
Oh,
Like,
that's so awesome.
I was like,
Oh.
oh, that's awesome. Yeah,
Because
so.
I think this also relates to the type of fan mail we're talking about here is not just, hell yeah, I'm a big fan of yours, but I want to participate in an intellectual exchange with you. And that's really what our fan mail is too, of let's have a conversation and have some discourse.
So that's a perfect segue into us talking about some of the really cool fan mail that we got. I do think a lot of times we get some really insightful commentary on the topics that we're talking about. And for sure, I think the memory episode generated a lot of really interesting speculation, people sort of thinking through some of the ideas that we had talked about with Dr. Louise Freeman, and when we were talking about memory. And so let me start by reading a little excerpt from our listener, Matthew, who wrote to us about this, just the first episode, part one. And Matthew said this: "The idea that pensive memories are not as objective as presented sounds like a fascinating fanfic prompt, given that so much of Dumbledore's plan is based on the various memories he's compiled about Riddle." I love the notion that, this is maybe opening up some possibility for fan fiction. And I know I always feel like, anytime there's an opportunity for, fan fiction, some writers could get on that. What do you all think about that?
Yeah, it definitely kind of makes you wonder like what really happened, and it kind of makes you question your own memories. I feel on like I'm on very shaky ground anytime the subject of memory and what our human brains do with memories and how we transform our memories, for various purposes, some of them completely unconscious, it really makes me feel like I'm not on the stable ground that I think I'm on,
Well, and it makes me think of the literary technique of the unreliable narrator, right? And so it gives you like a great opportunity to just play around with that. Laurie, were you thinking the same thing?
You took the words out of my mouth. I was going to say unreliable narrator, yes, and I do feel like that's an invitation very much to say, well, what would it be like from someone else's perspective? What was it really like?
Yeah. And so now Matthew follows up though with saying, he says, "Though now that I think about it, doesn't Dumbledore brag about his own memory, meeting Riddle at the orphanage, being particularly clear and detailed?" Yes. And what is interesting to me is, like, does that mean it's more true?
Sometimes you bring details up about something that you say, oh, like you're having a conversation with someone. Oh, well, no, we definitely talked about it because we were at that coffee shop and you went and added honey to your tea. Like I remember, by adding little details, it does make it seem like, well, it definitely happened because I know something else. But does that necessarily mean that just because you remember another detail, that the whole conversation went the way that you portrayed it?
And this is in the context of the notion that the pensive is not just like a diary. So it's not supposed to be exclusively subjective. It really is supposed to be kind of more accurate. But we were really challenging that during the episode. And so Matthew continues, "Snape's recollections in The Prince's Tale were always somewhat suspicious. Why did he include those memories? What is he leaving out?" But if the memories themselves are realistically fuzzy, it makes me question if Harry actually needed to sacrifice himself or if that was wishful thinking on Snape's part. Right? That's really interesting, right?
Oof.
Thinking about, is there some
Ouch.
manipulation with that
I mean,
final
Dumbledore
memory?
in King's Cross does basically verify that story, that is what Dumbledore agreed to, although it would be a wild thing if he showed up and Dumbledore was like, no, what are you doing here? I never told Snape to do that.
Would really
Yeah.
evacuate some of the kind of nobility of Harry's sacrifice.
There's
Actually,
Harry
no,
doing
that.
it's Snape's triple agenting it up here.
Yeah. And Harry, you know, doing his little hero thing again. What is it? Does Hermione say that? You kind of have a hero thing.
Right, a saving people
thing.
thing.
Saving people thing. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I do think some people have really good memories and really good ability. I mean, really, it's observational skills and the ability. Like, I know mine's terrible, but I do think that there are some people who do have. I mean, maybe Dumbledore is one of these people. I mean, I would probably peg him as one of these who just has a really truly excellent memory and ability to observe and ability to retain those details that they observe. So I'm gonna hold on to my version where Harry really did need to sacrifice himself.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. But both for the reasons that both of you said, right, and the fact that it is one of the things as historians, we're always dealing with quite imperfect sources that are never completely reliable. But one of the ways that you do deal with that is through corroboration.
Right.
And so we have some corroboration of some of these pensive memories. But that's a really intriguing point. So much relies on this pensive set of memories that Snape, you know, kind of leaves as his legacy to Harry, which I think is just, it's wow. It's fascinating.
Also, you know, he makes his love of Lily look like, to Harry, love,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to, if it were coming from Lily's perspective, would it have been creepy and mm-hmm. unwanted?
Such as my letters to James Taylor. Yes.
Perhaps. Bringing it back. But yeah, that's one way to think about it. Harry sees this because it's presented by Snape as this love, true, beautiful, pure love for his mother from a different perspective from James or even Lupin or Sirius's perspective. If they were like seeing this, is it just creepy? Is it just
stalker?
Do you think it was presented as pure though? Because I think even
no.
in the memories, it doesn't really come across as pure. I think it's love in all of its.
But
you know,
Harry reads it as love.
Yes, as love.
Yeah, yeah. That's
Harry
true.
Does not read. Harry says like he was in love with my mother, and even Voldemort tries to twist it as like, oh, he wanted her, he desired her.
Mm.
It doesn't mean he loved her, and Harry's like, no, he did.
Yeah,
Harry does believe that.
You also
that
have the
was
evidence.
Love.
You also have the evidence of his Patronus, you know, where I mean, I think there's something about a Patronus that can't really lie. I don't, you know, I mean, right? Like Tonks.
It's so pure, you can't like trick it into turning into something.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not like a pure.
It's coming from a pure place, and you can't really consciously manipulate it in the way that you know Tonks was not able. She had difficulties with hers. After, you know, in the midst of her back and forth with Lupin.
But you can be self-deluded, right? Snape thinks that what he feels is a true and beautiful.
Well, then what's to say it's not?
Yes. And I guess that's not maybe what I'm questioning. Something about the purity of it. Like, I think there's a lot of complicated and dark things going on with Snape's love for Lily,
mm-hmm.
right?
Sure.
There's jealousy and there's prejudice, and then in the end there's a willingness to betray someone she loves for his love, and then what is he doing after she dies? He's doing it for her, but as penance in a way. I'm just suggesting I don't know if it's exactly pure.
I take back pure. I do not think Snape's love
okay.
is pure at all. But it's that Harry clearly is won over enough by those memories to name his child for him.
Oh, yeah. Right. No, that's an excellent point. Yeah. And I guess I was just thinking in terms of Snape you know, even if he's coloring his memories, I think we get this a sense of some of the darker shades of that love that he
And
had for Lily.
self-loathing. Like, if nothing else,
Yeah.
Snape does not think highly of himself.
That's a good
Poor
point.
kid.
Yeah,
Poor
you know,
kid.
you could actually do a reading of pensive memories where you kind of decoded them for the self-perceptions of the people whose memories are being mined in this way. Ah, that could be a really interesting way to do close reading of pensive memories.
Spreadsheet. Spreadsheets
Somebody
involved.
get on that.
We hand out lots of homework here on
Yes,
Potterversity.
that's right. That's right.
This is the assignment.
That's right. So Matthew continues, though. Matthew's got a theory on this as well. And Matthew says, I've generally reconciled the issue by deciding that a pensive is a scrying tool. I love this idea. You're not viewing the memory, you're viewing a moment in the past with a memory as a focus. And the issue with Slughorn's memory is that he cannot admit to himself about what happened. So he's unable to properly focus on the memory, hence Harry needing to essentially force him to reflect on it. A
Scrying
scrying
tool.
tool, viewing a moment in the past with memory as the focus.
That would be such an interesting paper to talk about the pensive and various scrying tools throughout history and their use and compare it with that and then maybe even do the coding thing, you know, where you code the memories based on people's self-perception. Yeah. Matthew, I think you've got homework.
Yeah, and you know, and I talked about this in the episode that I did a little paper on the pensive and the time turner as vehicles through which to understand what's happened in the past and history, and that the pensive is just a little too perfect. But what I like about what Matthew is saying here is that we don't necessarily have to read it as perfect, and that there are maybe some ways that you can muddy it up a little bit based on
Yeah.
what we can see in the
There's
text.
also, I think, the idea of we've been talking mostly about pensive as the memories can be manipulated based on like what you want to believe about yourself, how you want to portray it to someone else, how much you have told the truth to yourself. But you can also be haunted by a memory. Sometimes you have an image in your mind that you're like, God, I wish I could unsee that. So
Yes.
I wonder also about remembering in spite of yourself. So Matthew brings up this idea of like, Slughorn's memory, like he, you know, has to be forced to even think about it, really. But I wonder how you compare that to ideas that maybe for someone like Snape haunt him to this day, and you couldn't, like, that you'd rather forget about, you'd rather try to wish they went a different way. But a memory that's so clear, despite your best, you know, wishes, that you can still remember, oh, that horrible thing you saw in a movie that you're like, God, I wish I had not. Oh, kept my eyes open for that scene, but you can remember it in perfect detail right as you're trying to close your eyes and go to sleep. So I think that kind of lends itself to the scrying tool that, like, the past is there. How much are you reconstructing purposely, or is there naturally, versus how much is just you don't even necessarily want it there, but it's clear in your mind.
Much to ponder. I
Much to
felt this way
ponder.
in the memory episode itself. I was like, there's so much to think about here. Right. Well, so that was our very interesting letter from Matthew, aka absent-minded Raven. Of course, a
Great name.
Ravenclaw gave us this.
Thanks, Matthew.
Yeah. So interesting to think about that. And we also have some thoughts on the pensive from Abigail. Abigail says, I wonder if the pensive could be considered like a very vivid bullet journal slash note system slash life organization system. And I mean, I think that's really interesting because that's actually one of the things Dumbledore says about it. You know, when you've got thoughts all jumbled up here and you can just take one out and put it in the pensive so you can actually kind of see it and, you know, maybe put something in, you know, in the right juxtaposition and sort of siphon off the other thoughts that might be getting in the way. What do you all think about that?
I mean, I think that's why I do make, you know, the lists that I make. You know, I mean, that's because there's just so much jumbling up in my head. Now, like, I guess it would, you know, probably serve in some more complex situations where I'm trying to make a big decision. I haven't really had to do that in a while, so I'm not sure I can identify with that in terms of a big decision. But that's definitely the way I use, you know, the lists of things or even ideas that I have that I know are going to flit away if I don't stick a pin in them.
Now that's interesting, right? Because you're using it as a like a memory assister as well. Like I want to remember this one. So let me put it in the pensive or write it down. I don't know if you all have this. I will be unable to sleep in the middle of the night because I have stuff floating around up there. And I'm just chewing on it. I don't know what to do. It's all roiling around in my brain. And sometimes I just have to get up and write. It often appears in the form of an angry letter. But
not to your favorite authors.
No, but sometimes it is a sort of, and it often has to do with me trying to figure out a way to express something about something that happened earlier in the day. And just trying to put words to it as a way to understand this idea about what happened in the past and the feelings that I have about it as well. I don't know, Lori, what about you? What do you think?
I'm thinking about Dumbledore's first time we see Dumbledore's memories, Harry's first encounter with the Pensieve, where Dumbledore has the memories from the trials that over which Mr. Crouch presided, and how that's not necessarily a memory that I think Dumbledore's been like kicking around all these years and regularly going back to. And like, you know, because there are some that maybe, for example, Voldemort related ones that he's held on to for a long time that he's thought about and revisited many times. And so it's interesting to think just a scenario coming up that you go, ooh, I have to stop and think. So like this was after Mr. Crouch showed up speaking, you know, very upset, had seemed like he'd escaped from somewhere. No one knew what was going on. Like that was a moment for Dumbledore to say, hold on. Could this connect back to something with all those years ago with Crouch and Death Eaters? And that's an interesting one to me of like pulling, not something that he would have necessarily thought at the time to put in the Pensieve. That it seems like there are some memories that like, oh, you know, this is going to be important. Let's tuck that one away. And ones that just like, huh, suddenly I want to go back and think about that day. And this is an opportunity, I think, where he's reflecting on something that he would not regularly think about. But you can bring that to the top of your mind. Something that was maybe in the back.
I mean, I know this has been said and done before, but I'm always struck by, I'm reading a lot of murder mysteries right now, and I'm always so struck by how much murder mystery there is in Harry Potter. The way that the plot is
murdery.
Is devised. Yeah. And even when it's not, I mean, it is murdery, but even when the solution in the end is not whodunit, you know, necessarily. And that's a big surprise. I mean, usually there is some element of somebody working behind the scenes that you didn't know was doing that. But there is just so much of the classic murder mystery in these stories that I do wonder how much influence, you know, certain murder mystery authors have had over her. And
more
than I think she's probably talked about.
We have an old Reading, Writing, Rolling episode about detective fiction and the Harry Potter novels and the basically very consistent structuring between those two genres. And I always thought too that when she's no longer writing Harry Potter, I was like, she's got to write detective fiction. And look at that.
And look. Like, has there ever been anything done on P.D. James and her?
I don't know.
I think so. I think I have read about comparisons with P.D. James. This sounds familiar. But I'm also now thinking about, here's another fanfic prompt for someone, Detective Dumbledore. He's on the case. He's not what you'd expect. He's not your regular old gumshoe. He's
have a mashup. Dumbledore and Obi-Wan Kenobi. Solving the case together.
Yeah. Dumbledore has got, you know, like his little half moon glasses that he pulls down to look over some clues.
And Obi-Wan's constantly running his hand through his hair, you know?
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, just like stalking the streets of Hogsmeade. Exchanging wand a bit of money, going and talking to the bartender ready. At the Hogshead. Totally. To be like, I hear you have totally a hot tip for me.
I love
he's got a very noir.
This.
So it's in black and white.
Yeah.
And he's got a noir like theme song.
How will you see Dumbledore's purple close though, because I feel like he just always, if he's gonna go around like a detective, he needs to always be wearing a purple cloak.
I'm into the noir black and white. I think that could be conveyed.
It's like in the pensive, not the pensive, sorry, but also in the diary memories.
Yes.
Where they're black and white. Detective Dumbledore.
Sepia tone.
Oh wow. All right. Lots of suggestions for the creative listeners out there. Abigail continues on this theme of thinking about the pensive as a, you know, kind of life organization system. And Abigail says, you can use lists or mind maps to connect ideas in writing, which is hard to do purely by thinking. It also helps you to stop worrying that you're going to forget something because it is written down. It is free to slip to the back of your mind if needed. So I love that because I think that's basically a lot of what we were just talking about as well.
Yes. Yes.
Like make a shopping list, but I know I'm going to misplace the shopping list. Can I just think about all the things I need and then take that memory out or like write it down once, then take that memory out, put it in the pensive, and then like I can lose the shopping list, but I'll remember because I took a pensive to remind me of my shopping list.
Well, but the pensive is big. You can't just walk around with a pensive.
No. You
right?
Can't.
No, but I can like check it for like next week if I said like, now I'm actually going shopping.
Unless it's at the grocery with you, it's of no help. But
that's why you take a photo on your phone or you write it on
exactly.
your phone.
So. That's the modern muggle equivalent.
Are our phones our own pensives?
Oh my gosh.
Okay, Facebook memories. Bear with me here for a moment. I was telling someone Facebook has all these problems, but I'm often called a boomer despite being a young millennial because I'm really attached to Facebook. And part of it is that I've had Facebook for over 15 years and it's a repository of my memories. And I love getting my daily, like, here are your memories from this day. I mean, not always. I have a couple of like really emo lyrics I posted when I was crushing on someone or something when I was 14.
Aww. But, looking those up.
Aside from that, there's a lot of like, oh, that was the day I went to that place or I was in that show in college. Oh, that was that must have been when I was watching Lord of the Rings and I couldn't stop talking about it. Like, and so in a way, basic memories are my pensive.
Oh, wow.
This is fascinating.
It is. It
is. I have no doubt about that. I mean, the whole phone.
Again, we see magic and technology, you know, there's a very, very fuzzy line between these things.
So one of the things that maybe is a little different, though, is that when you're posting something on Facebook, it is for public consumption. And I think the pensive is really a private, although Dumbledore kind of lets Harry use it. It's suggested that Harry intrudes at first, but I don't really think, I think that was planned myself.
I think just personally using Facebook as a repository for memories at this point, though.
Yeah.
Like, I go on a vacation, I know I have too many photos and no one's going to look through all the photos, but I want to keep the photos and I'm not going to print them out and put them in a photo album in this day and age. So I'm going to put them on Facebook and then I can go back and look through them.
That's right. So you're counting on people's lack of interest to keep it private.
And you can always set it to private. I have gone back in my Facebook memory, seen something and I was like, oh my God, I can't believe I posted that. I'm going to make that private. It's just for me now.
Yeah. Okay. So that's cool. That's a kind of way to think about it. Yeah.
Again, technology as magic, magic as technology.
Is it Arthur C. Clarke?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
But the phone you can carry in your pocket to the grocery store with you.
That's why I do snap a lot of pictures.
Or like, okay, when we were at the Harry Potter Academic Conference at Chestnut Hill, I was talking to our new friend, Dorothea Kiter, who had studied in Freiburg, and I had just been in Freiburg several months before. And she was like, oh, what places did you go? And I couldn't remember everywhere that I'd went, but I pulled it up on my phone and went through the photos that I had. And there was someone who wanted to see everyone and go, oh, I remember that place. Yeah, I know that street. And now on the phones too, it even tells you, like, without you even labeling it yourself, it knows the location. So it was like my own little pensive to pull up, the memories that I didn't remember off the top of my head. It's a photo album.
It's
cool. All the things.
This is cool. Okay. And then Abigail brings up this point, and this is a point that also our next letter writer had made as well. So I think we could spend a little time on this one particularly. Abigail says, second, writing things down that are bothering you is often advised in therapy as a way of helping to process your thoughts and take your mind off an issue. I wonder if the way Snape puts the memory of the bullying into the pensive is a bit like writing it down. You haven't removed it from your memory, but you have put it away from the forefront of your mind and have practiced observing the memory as a dispassionate observer. So if occlumency occurs, you have more chance to put up a defense before the memory is reached. That's interesting. Like the to-do list, the memory still exists in your mind, but in a more organized, less vulnerable place, meaning it's less likely to be seen before you can fight back. I think there's a lot to unravel there, right? So first, we've got this idea about pensive as a kind of therapy. And that when we, if we could get outside of ourselves and see a moment in the past and see ourselves in it, then maybe we could get some distance on it to be dispassionate about it, as Abigail says, and that that has this therapeutic quality. But then a sort of second part of what Abigail is saying is that this then can become a defense mechanism for those tender spots, right, that might still exist within ourselves, especially with traumatic memories. And having the dispassionate idea out front can be a little armor. What do y'all think of those ideas?
Well, I think it's really great. And I also can see why Snape would want to share that memory with Harry in that form instead of just telling him. Harry wasn't going to believe anything Snape said.
But isn't but he Snape really mad?
But he didn't want to share it. The point was to keep it away from him.
Yeah, that's
true. And I think
true.
Because it's such a vulnerable memory, because he had
said
before, because
it was in the occlumency class, not in the Snape's, the last memories that he shares.
Right.
No, so Snape had already told Harry before that he hated his father. Like, that had been made very clear already.
We knew
he hated Sirius too. But he really didn't want to show, I think, that memory that for him is so raw and embarrassing.
And embarrassing. Yeah, that's true. That's true.
He gets really mad about it too.
You're right.
So it is still like, and that's so, but that's also, that's not a pensive memory, right? The book that in the occlumency lesson.
Right. That's a mind reading memory.
No. I think you guys are confusing the movie and the book. In the book, Snape takes it out and puts it in the pensive. And then when he has to go outside, Harry goes into it without his permission. In the movie, they didn't do the pensive there. They just had Harry bounce it back to him.
I thought Harry was
using legilimency, but no. Okay.
That's such an important distinction.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it doesn't seem like it, but it is.
Yeah, that Snape takes special care to get that out of there. Maybe even knowing that. I wouldn't know. Mm-hmm. Snape obviously has a lot of secrets that he wouldn't want Harry to see. But interesting that that's like the first one, at least that comes up when Harry touches the pensive, because when dealing with Harry in this, obviously he's good at occlumency. You shouldn't have a problem if Harry manages to do it back to him. But probably seeing Harry makes exactly that. That's the first thing he's thinking about, is how, not only how much he hated his dad, but how humiliated he was by him. It's the most vulnerable part that he doesn't want Harry to see.
That's so sad, because it's like what I was saying is like, it seems like it would maybe change Harry's perspective about Snape, like in a positive way, in a way that would help him relate to Snape better. But Kate's
it's
just
toxic
shaking her
masculinity.
Head.
The toxic masculinity makes that impossible for Snape to think about. And
I think let his guard down and be vulnerable.
No,
he has a victim complex, but he doesn't want to have a victim complex.
He doesn't
want to
say.
No, he wants
he
to
one.
Say, "Hey,
want to
your father made my life a living hell, and he was awful." And so serious, but he wants that to be, they were bad, not it actually got to me. And I was actually able to be embarrassed and humiliated by them. Which also I think shows that, you know, in Abigail's thinking here about, you can like be a more dispassionate observer. Clearly that is not the case for Snape.
He has not
made himself any less angry.
Yeah.
I think by taking it out.
What if Snape had lessons with Tuvok from Voyager?
You're speaking my language, Emily.
I'm so into the mashups today.
I told you we should do a Star Trek episode. Write to us at PotterVersityPodcast@gmail.com if you want the Star Trek Harry Potter Potterversity episode.
Me, I'm going to write.
Yeah,
I feel like Tuvok did a lot of good with a lot of people on that ship.
I was just thinking about the one with Suter, that Betazoid. Oh,
yes.
As I was
we just watched
Ragtime yesterday, and the guy who played Suter is in it. Also, Ethan Phillips is in it with no lines as a police officer. Bunch of random, like, very early in their career people in Ragtime. Recommend. Fran Drescher for a single scene. Jeff Daniels, one scene. Samuel L. Jackson, one scene.
Wow.
But yes, in Tuvok helps various people with his Vulcan skills of mind melding and helping people deal with their memories and their emotions. Well, I mean, I think we can all agree that Snape needed therapy.
Yes, whether or not it's Vulcan therapy.
If you think about the pensive as a therapeutic tool, like you're just trying to use it yourself. How therapeutic maybe is that going to be if you don't have somebody helping you to use it in a, you know, in a way that is positive? I mean, I don't know. Maybe you can, I think maybe you can do some things that are therapeutic for yourself. I'm not, I guess I shouldn't just blanket say that that's not okay, but it's not working for Snape.
I don't think he's trying to work on it either, though.
Oh, no, you're right. He's not using it.
He's holding on to it. Mm-hmm. He's not putting it away in order to, you know, try to move on and have a good session with Harry. He's putting it away because he cannot control himself when he's thinking about it.
Yeah. And I mean, I think he kind of uses some of this anger as fuel for his, you know, devotion to doing what Dumbledore tells him to do and his scheming. I mean, he and Dumbledore, I'm sure, were scheming together. You don't have a guy as intelligent as Snape and not, you know, bring him in to some degree on your plans and your planning and your...
Unless you're Dumbledore.
Unless...
Who does Dumbledore confide in? Nobody. Occasionally McGonagall will get a little flicker of what's going on, but in code.
Do you think he didn't really, I mean, he confided in Snape things that other people didn't know. Like about Harry.
I think he confided only as much as he felt he needed
to
get Snape to participate in the way that he wanted him to. Dumbledore's just very manipulative. I don't even say that as an insult, really. That's just,
That's what makes him such a good noir detective. Dumbledore.
Just like
I was thinking, though, do you think that Dumbledore ever uses the pensive in a therapeutic way for himself? Because he's got lots of unresolved issues, too.
I think Dumbledore actually has quite a few relatively resolved issues.
Okay.
I think that Dumbledore, I'm going to defend Dumbledore here. I think Dumbledore, for the most part, has done the work. You know, Hermione talks about, well, he did a lot of, you know, we're finding out that he did all this terrible, he had all these terrible beliefs in his young adulthood, late adolescence, but he spent his whole career, his whole life trying to do better than that. So I think Dumbledore has faced up to, I think that's why Dumbledore is like true redemption compared to someone like Snape or Kylo Ren, or these characters who basically have to die to be redeemed because like they, like, can basically do nothing and it's like they're good because they sacrifice themselves. Dumbledore, I think, is a rare example of a character who like spent however many years, however old he's actually supposed to be, like a century of his life actually trying to mostly do good after having a couple of years, maybe if even that much, of messed up ideas.
He still cursed himself by trying to get to the Resurrection Stone.
Yeah, I was going to say that's the one thing he still clearly has not fully
managed
to deal with, Ariana and the loss of her. Mm-hmm. But I think otherwise, I think he has done quite a lot of work on himself, and I commend him for that.
Do you think the Pensieve had a role in any of that, though? I mean, when we see his memories in the Pensieve, they are very Detective Dumbledore. They don't really seem like they're... personal, you know what
I'm
saying?
Well, he's not going to share those with Harry.
No.
But that's not to say he hasn't looked at it himself.
He's got
but
those.
Could it also be bad? If you're harping on your memories again and again, if he every week is pulling out his memories of Ariana and looking at them in the Pensieve and like grieving her again and again, is that bad if you're constantly revisiting the same memories that aren't good for you? Same for Snape. If he's thinking all the time about that moment with the Marauders, that fuels his anger.
Mm-hmm. And this is what Abigail is saying, like that you can take it off your mind for some time. It's just not, it doesn't have to be at the forefront of your mind.
Right.
Yeah. So Abigail continues, lots of great insights in Abigail's letter. Thank you so much, Abigail. Finally, Abigail says, this might also explain why it's not used in the trial or as evidence of Voldemort's return. Now, this is, I think, a really good point. Pensive memories are not really used in this legal sense that we know of. And that seems like an oversight. Okay. Abigail says, while looking back at a date in your personal diary or journal might help you see the truth of what you felt happened that day, it's still a personal record. And so if someone doesn't trust you, the memory could easily be said to have been manipulated or the product of a fanciful imagination. If Fudge doesn't believe Harry's detailed story about the graveyard, seeing it wouldn't convince him, right? Mm. Harry could just have visualized that happening in the same way Harry has made up what he is telling Fudge. So I find that interesting that you could make a false memory. And of course, we know that this happens in psychology as well. And they're not easily distinguished like they are in Slughorn's case. And the idea that even though the pensive might actually be more accurate than just a personal or subjective recollection, if we go with that interpretation, that nevertheless, if a person doesn't trust you or your version of events, that pensive memory is not going to suddenly convince them, no, this is the objective reality. So I find that interesting, right, to include, like, who would have to believe this memory?
Well, and maybe that is the other shoe dropping on my idea that if, you know, that Harry seeing the bullying memories would have caused him to feel differently towards Snape. I mean, in the reality, it only caused him to feel differently toward his father and Sirius, I guess.
That's interesting. I was thinking about how, like, Snape doesn't think that it would make Harry feel differently about his father, though.
Right. Well, he's got more experience with the pensive, perhaps, you know.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So we have also from David Martin, our friend David Martin, Hufflepuff extraordinaire. David has written us about Obliviate, also kind of on this topic of using a memory aid or memory tool. I don't know what we would call it exactly, for therapeutic reasons. And this is what David says. First, there is this incident in Deathly Hallows when Obliviate was clearly both the ethically and the tactically best choice. And that was wiping memories of Death Eaters in Deathly Hallows. And then David Martin says, secondly, we've learned a great deal in the past few decades about the long-term effects of being in horrible situations, such as abusive childhoods or war or rape. Assuming that such things happen in the wizarding world as well, might Obliviate be part of a treatment to relieve such suffering? And we had talked a lot about the ethics of Obliviate. And I think this is such an interesting issue when, you know, there's all kinds of people have become, I think, newly aware of trauma and the way that trauma impacts people and, you know, changes the way they experience the world, but also understand themselves. Would there be some relief possible if you could Obliviate someone who's been through a really traumatic event?
Well, I'm thinking particularly about a show I just started watching, Severance. Which the first season came out a few years ago, but I just started watching it, and it is about people who literally sever their work lives and their personal lives so that they have no memory of one when they're at the other. And the main character, I mean, mild spoilers, this is established in the first episode. The main character played by Adam Scott, turns out that his wife died, and the reason that he wanted to do this job where his mind is severed at work is so basically he can get away from his grief 8 hours a day and not remember it. And there's some discussion of whether that's A, effective, B, helpful for actually coping with it. Because, I mean, it might be different if we're talking Obliviate and they don't remember it at all, but this is for part of the day. And they even show him in the first episode sobbing before he goes into work. And then he gets into work and he changes, but like he's still sniffling and his eyes are still red. And that's something that his colleagues notice that, oh yeah, he always comes in with like red eyes and sniffly. But no one has any idea of why that is. And he doesn't even have any idea of why that is. And is it actually getting you anywhere, dealing with it, to just take out the memory of it? Does that still impact who he is and his mood, even if the memory is gone?
And what does that say about work? I mean, come on, we gotta leave ourselves behind so that we can be drones for the capitalist
The show is very compelling. Highly recommend.
Cordoning off your grief like that, is that good? Cordoning it off so that you don't feel it all the time. I mean, I like feeling grief all the time sucks, but does the compartmentalization help or not? I don't know.
Yeah, does it make it worse when he gets out because he hasn't had 8 hours of thinking about other things? He's just sitting with his grief at the other times?
He's not having to merge the grief into other parts of his life in a way that would be healthy, maybe.
Well, and I was just looking up the Star Trek episode, the TNG episode that I just watched. It's called The Bonding, season 3, episode 5. And the ship's archaeologist is killed on a mission led by Worf and leaving behind a 12-year-old son whose father had already died 5 years before. So his child is orphaned. And so this entity kind of invades the Enterprise and like sets up this mirage of his mother and their former apartment and their cat Patches. And you know, I gotta love it when there's a cat in Star Trek. It's great. And the whole question is, do we allow this child who's hurting so badly to live in this mirage, you know, and to have the relief from his grief? But they're very, you know, the Enterprise, especially Picard, is very clear that no, you know, part of what it means to be human is to integrate these losses in our lives and move, and thus, you know, move past them by giving them meaning. It was a meaningless death. It was she died from an explosion from a war that had, like a landmine that had been left behind, you know, many years. And so it was like, you know, this pointless death. And Worf had borne it, you know, very hard too, because he's Worf. And he had led the mission. And so in the end, it ended up that the boy and Worf, you know, bond, you know, have this, go through this Klingon bonding ceremony because they're both, you know, feeling the grief, you know, to different degrees, but they're both feeling this grief. And so they sort of bond together over the grief and create meaning.
But it does not do to dwell on dreams and forget to live.
Forget to live.
I'm going to give another Star Trek war focused episode from DS9. Oh God, I'm blanking on, is it called Sons of Moog or is that a different episode? No, it is Sons of Moog. DS9, season 4, episode 14, where Worf's brother Kern comes back and he wants Worf to kill him because he like cannot live with the shame that exists in their house within the Klingon Empire, and Worf lives outside of the Klingon Empire, so like it's okay for him being in the Federation. But what Worf ends up doing for his brother instead of killing him is wiping his memory and giving him a new life as the son of someone else whose son had died. And it's like, because based on Klingon concepts of honor, Kern cannot live with this dishonor and the memory of it and being this person in this society. And the solution is literally wipe his memory of it and tell him, oh, you had a head injury in a crash and now you have amnesia. But this other guy who has a good honorable lineage where you could happily live, you're his son, actually, and he will, you know, tell you about the life that you've forgotten. And, like, that's where they end with Kern. And even after Worf, like, you know, ends up becoming ambassador to the Klingon Empire, like, this is now what Kern's entirely false life is. And I don't know, maybe there's a comic or a novel where he goes back and tells Kern, actually, sorry, like, you can come back. But it's, like, a wild solution they have.
Yeah, so Star Trek doesn't know what to think about this either.
But it wants to think about it.
But it's thinking about it.
And it wants us to think about it.
Yeah, yeah. And the Harry Potter novels are so much about grief. And like nobody talks about taking away Harry's grief. And of course, Harry is trying to remember the trauma of his parents' death at various points in the novel as well. So, you know, I don't know that the novels are in favor of that.
Sometimes the memories, though, like, you know, make him feel closer to them because part of his, for him, part of the trauma is not remembering his parents.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So on the one hand, yes, it's like, well, there's no one to remember. He never knew what it was like to have parents. But having any memories that come up of them makes him feel closer in a way.
Doesn't he even kind of have a sick feeling of when the Dementors swoop down on him and hearing his mother's voice, like there's this kind of a sick desire to have that happen again because at least mm-hmm. he got to hear her voice.
Mm-hmm. So there's a value there in a memory for him, even if it's not a positive memory, which of course comes up too with like casting a Patronus, like a strong memory, even if it's not happy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's why I love those moments in the series where somebody does something for him that allows him to really connect with them in a healthy way. Like when Hagrid gives him the book of photos, you know, of his parents and their crowd. And Sirius talks to him about the photo of Dumbledore's army and because he can integrate.
The first part of David's comment had to do with wiping the evil people's memories so that you could get away. And it just sort of made me wonder, like, if wiping somebody's memory can be like a tactical weapon, like, how could you even ever believe anything about what you remembered and what you didn't if you had been in any kind of conflict where it was possible somebody knew that kind of magic?
Oh, God. Like, how can we trust our memories? Because who knows if I've been obliterated at some point in my life?
Right? Wouldn't magical people be always like, I don't know, like, well, maybe that did happen and I was just obliterated. I would be using that all the time as an excuse, by the way.
Yeah.
Instead of time travel, oh, God, I'd love to undo what I said 5 minutes ago. Just be like, we're just going to forget I said that. Literally forget I said that.
I have a friend who always goes, brain erasure. Brain erasure.
Yeah, but I mean, think about that. Like, if that's something that is being practiced, and that's not an unforgivable curse or anything, you know?
I guess you'd have to be really good at it, like the way they have the Ministry's memory modification squads, to actually make it right. Because otherwise someone would be like, whoa, what happened here? Where am I? Someone mm-hmm. messed with, like, you would realize mm-hmm. that something's been wiped, unless they're really, really good at it.
Like the teenagers in that Deathly Hallows scene.
Hermione.
And that's right. That's right. Hermione, she's pretty badass. Yeah, and isn't there, there's somebody that Lockhart obliterated too many times. Something.
Oh, was it one of the authors who's, well, not real authors, one of the people whose work he stole?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's in the, maybe in the end of Chamber.
Yeah. So listeners, if you know of any of that, if you are, you know, attuned to write to us.
Send it in.
Yeah. And we'll conclude. So those were all of our memory pieces of mail, which so cool. So cool to think about those. And I guess you can never settle on what's the correct answer on some mm-hmm. of these questions, which makes them, it's part of what's so fun to talk about in regard to them. But David Martin also sent us, I think, a very interesting, useful comment on our episode about monsters and the monstrous, where we particularly talked about how do you separate, you know, the art or the work from the person who created it, from the artist, when there are things about that person that you find monstrous. And David offers us this. He says, once before or during the Reformation, many of the faithful began to worry about their own salvation as they realized how corrupt some of the clergy had become. Seeking to reassure the faithful, one member of the hierarchy sent a short message to them. Quote, "The light of the sun still warms us, even when it comes through a dirty window." I think that's a great image. The light of the sun still warms us, even when it comes through a dirty window.
I can attest to that in my house.
Don't do a lot of window cleaning.
No, taking it very literally.
I really wish I had the Scourgify charm ability on those windows. Yeah.
I mean, I think about what Daniel Radcliffe had to say, where he's like, if these stories meant anything to you,
mm-hmm.
you know, then that's it. Nothing needs to take that away.
Yeah. Yeah. That's in the front of Lana Whited's recent mm-hmm. collection.
Mm-hmm. The Ivory Tower, Harry Potter and Beyond. Mm-hmm.
To put it in a way that's just like less eloquent and has less gravitas, even a broken clock is right twice a day, right? Like, might not come from a source you generally trust, but like, okay, they did mm-hmm. something that spoke truth.
Yeah, right. And that doesn't mean that everything, I mean, you know, some things are being blocked. It doesn't mean that everything is like true or accurate, but you know, there are things that maybe we can find. And of course, all people are imperfect. So.
Yeah, and I like the metaphor in the story David told because it is true. I mean, you still can get warm, but if you get those windows clean, you'll be even warmer.
Yeah.
And it'll look nicer. Look, you know me, I'm always
Right.
concerned with the aesthetic, especially in church.
Yeah.
So,
What about like stained glass? Like there's an did stained glass is really beautiful, and sometimes I might be taking this metaphor too far. Stained glass, it's stained, but it's not literally dirty stained. It's stained with colors, and that can make a really beautiful shadow than like just a plain window.
Right. It's diverse in its
I
color and
don't know what I'm getting
appearance.
at here.
Yeah, but hey, what if we like sometimes the flaws enhance the power and the beauty
Of a piece of,
of the sunlight
yes.
streaming through.
Yeah.
I mean, we have talked about, for example, we are having conversations that we might not have had about the series, about various topics in it, if not for being really disappointed with the author.
Yeah.
So in that way, not to say it's a good thing, but like there even greater discourse, conversation, truths, enlightenment is coming as a result, maybe. I'm
Yeah,
just
and I
trying to take this metaphor a little too far, possibly.
no, I like it. I like it. And I think that there has been in the wake of her behavior, there have been, you know, rushes to criticize the work. But I think some of those are legitimate. I think there's some that aren't. And then I think that there's some that are very much so. And I think that over time, yeah, it will probably help those of us who love the books, don't love how the author has behaved. But want to think critically about them. It'll help us take ourselves a little bit outside of the conversation and look with different eyes.
And I was always a little uncomfortable with some of the hero worship, you know. I think a lot of us had, we were expecting perfection, maybe, or, you know, and people, I guess, just aren't, they'll always disappoint you. I
Yes.
can't leave on that note, though.
So often they will. Well, it was point people back to that great episode with Lori Kim, who joined us to talk about Claire Detterer's book, Monsters, A Fan's Dilemma. It was
Which is a
not too long
wonderful
ago.
book. And if there
Yeah.
is an author who you love who's turned out to have some problematic parts of their personal life,
Yeah.
this book is it's not a polemic. It is not trying, it's not mandating that you think a certain way. It is an exploration of the issue that I found very helpful in my thinking as well. So yeah, that was
Very
great.
much
And what
so.
a good discussion we had with Lori Kim on that
Yeah,
as well.
absolutely. Thanks for writing in about it.
Yes, and thank you to all of our letter writers. And if you have an idea, if you're just tossing something around in your mind, we would love to hear from you. Maybe we'll read your email on the show, and as a part of another Owlpost. And thank you to everyone who wrote in. I think as we indicated, like I think we understand it's not always easy to write in. We're reading what you write, and we are interested in hearing from you. Well, thank you, Lori Beckoff, for joining us on the show.
Thanks,
Thanks,
Lori. I'm the one who makes the schedule of guests most of the time, so I just invite myself on when I
I
want to
love it.
talk.
Yes. This was a great idea. I was so glad to to be able to engage with these issues again, you know. Sometimes we do an episode and I do feel like, oh, there's more we could possibly have said about that. So our closing quote today will be from Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. Just then, the mail arrived. Harry had gotten used to this by now, but it had given him a bit of a shock on the first morning when about 100 owls had suddenly streamed into the great hall during breakfast, circling the tables until they saw their owners and dropping letters and packages onto their laps. Hedwig hadn't brought Harry anything so far. She sometimes flew in to nibble his ear and have a bit of toast before going off to sleep in the owlry with the other school owls. We would love to see your owl posts, listeners, so drop us a line.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Potterversity. Send us your thoughts on the episode or propose ideas for future episodes by writing to pottersversitypodcast@gmail.com. If you like the show, consider leaving a review on iTunes. And be sure to follow Potterversity on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Potterversity is brought to you by MuggleNet, the number one Wizarding World resource since 1999. Emma Nicholson is technical director, and the show is produced by Laurie Beckhoff. Our theme music is performed by The Town, featuring Sean Elsbernd, Scott Hacker, Travis Princey, Ashley Shepherd, and Emily Strand, and produced by Sean Elsbernd. I'm your announcer, Dr. Sarah Brown.
Until next time, class dismissed.